Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. As many of you know, the Independent Policy Forum is a regular series of lectures, seminars, debates, and other events we hold here in Oakland and elsewhere in the Bay Area. This evening, our program is entitled Solving America's Public School Crisis. As many of you know, the Institute is a public policy research institute. We sponsor many studies and produce many books. This is a copy of our journal, The Independent Review, which I hope everyone here subscribes to. And we hold many conference and media projects based on that, inviting people who produce books elsewhere as well, as with tonight. For those of you who are interested in further information on school choice or education in general issues, we also welcome you to visit our website and go to the archive page on education. I think you'll find quite a number of studies as well as transcripts of events that we've held in the past. In the packet, you'll find a program. It's a beige-colored program, which gives information about our speakers. And it's a nice program. It also mentions our next event, which is not scheduled yet, but will be on perhaps the other big event issue these days, the issue of the war in Iraq. And we hope that you can all join us at that time. If you're not already on our mailing list, including our email list, we hope that you will leave that information with us, because we notify people that way and keep you up to date on upcoming events as best we can. Also in your packet, you'll find information about a seminar program we put on each summer for high school and college students called the Summer Seminars in Political Economy. And these are one-week seminars, Monday through Friday mornings, which is co-sponsored by Holy Names College here in Oakland. Students also can receive a one-hour college course credit in economics by attending. It's a very popular program. If there are students that you know who could benefit from a better understanding of the world they live in, we strongly encourage you to consider having them apply. Another program which I wanted to mention to you that we're involved in dealing with education is called the Independent Scholarship Fund. It's a program that we operate in the East Bay counties of Alameda and Contra Costa. And it's a privately funded program to provide tuition assistance to the children of disadvantaged families. We currently work with about 100 schools. The program was started in 1999, and if you're interested in projects that help kids now without waiting for Sacramento or Washington and all the politics and disputes, this is a very efficient way of doing that. So we also welcome your involvement in that. Tonight's program, as you know, is on one of the most serious and widespread problems in American society, the increasing failure and problems in the public school system. For decades, of course, reformers have promised to improve public schools, but by and large, costs continue to escalate, even though funding has increased simultaneously. For those of you not familiar with the situation in Oakland, Oakland has the sixth largest public school district in California. The school system is headed for the most expensive bailout in California history, estimated at from $32 to $70 million. That's for 48,000 students, meaning that the bailout will be approximately $1,500 per student. This from a system that produces as many dropouts as graduates, and that 75% of those who do graduate read below the national average. A couple years ago, the state's fiscal crisis and management assistance team produced a 6-pound report in which the district received an F in every category. In response, the district adopted a number of school reforms, including smaller schools, a 25% raise in teacher salaries, and other reforms. And yet the overspending continued in special education, adult education, cafeteria fund, and a whole number of areas, with an accounting system to track it all that consisted of four separate accounting systems, four separate departments, none of which spoke to each other. So as former school finance troubleshooter Pete Yacidis, I believe that's how he pronounces his name, has indicated that on any given day he could request numbers, financial information, and the information would be off by at least millions of dollars any day. In response, the school superintendent, Dennis Chaconas, received a 33% raise in salary from the school board. Meanwhile, when a new accounting system was implemented, it became clear that deficits were skyrocketing. So how could this happen? And Oakland is not unique, as our speakers will attest. The original nature of government schools in the modern era started in Germany. It was actually adopted as a means to socialize and militarize youth to be submissive to the national government, especially for wars of conquest. That was the purpose of it. Later, it was adopted in other countries, including the U.S. The school system was actually intended to socialize immigrants, especially Catholic immigrants, who were considered to be not loyal to the national government. Interestingly enough, during this period of transition into compulsory education, the studies indicate that literacy levels dropped significantly, almost across the board. So handicapped by a government system of what I think is reasonable to say bureaucratic incompetence, public schools today operate in ways that would be unheard of in virtually any other field. I mean, you can imagine Intel or Coca-Cola or your church operating this way. I mean, it's inconceivable, and yet that's what we have. So as the public schools have become ever more bureaucratized and politicized, what can be done? How do we understand this? How do we communicate this to other people? So we're very pleased to have two authors and experts in education tonight. I'd like to first introduce a research fellow of ours, John Merrifield. John is a professor of economics at the University of Texas, San Antonio. His book that some of you have seen that just came out, we literally got copies today, is called School Choices, True and False. John received his PhD in economics from the University of Wyoming. He's been a planning analyst at the Illinois Bureau of the Budget. He's taught at the University of Illinois and the University of Hawaii. He's also the author of the book, The School Choice Wars, and the author of many articles in both academic and popular publications. John?
Thank you. I have my first cold in several years. I hope it doesn't show too much or amplify too much. I'm not used to having a microphone in my face from when I teach, but well. Hopefully, if I become more animated and move around, hopefully I'll know instinctively to turn the volume up, because usually I can project to the back of a room this size, but I'll try to stay parked by the microphone. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I looked at the calendar, and I looked at some of the work that I was doing, and I was about to cite the Nation at Risk Report, 1983, and I said, 1983, that's 20 years ago. Did we miss the anniversary already? Gosh, I hope not. We should do something to commemorate might not be the right word, but to at least remember. No, we haven't missed it yet, and hopefully for those of you in control of media outlets, do something on April 23rd, 2003, because it'll be the 20th anniversary of a presidential commission saying we're a nation at risk, and if a foreign government had done to us, given us our current education system, it would have been seen as an act of war. And we responded to this. I mean, I guess you could call it a response. I mean, there has been the equivalent of a full-court press in virtually all 50 states determined to figure out some way to force teachers in the system to be successful, and literally force, because that's how politics works. It passes more rules. It creates more restrictions. And sadly, this full-court press, this reform frenzy that we've been in and continue to be in, has... I guess to be optimistic, you'd have to say has produced a mixed bag of results. Most of what's in the bag, it seems to me, is pretty bad, but there's enough in there for an occasional politician to claim that they've produced some results and maybe to become president as a result of higher test scores in his former home state. Frankly, as a husband of a former teacher, college professor, I don't buy it. Things are ever worse, and the rate of decline is accelerating. We seem to do everything backwards. We have a system now, where I guess our latest attempt to make the system work is one in which we have high-stakes testing for schools, but not for children. So we have rallies where we try to beg the children to do well in a test that they don't really care about, and it doesn't really affect them, except for a few of the ones that control high school graduation. We have schools teaching this test because it does mean a lot to them and their ratings and how they look and whether people move into their neighborhoods. So they narrow their curriculum to where they do little else but teach what's on the test and push pretty much everything else off to the side. They no longer teach those things. And one of the reasons that my wife got out of the business of being a teacher is that they figure that if teachers aren't successful or they just haven't been given enough tools and been told enough things to make them successful. So teacher micromanagement is one of the things in this mixed bag that's suffered severely from this full court press 20 years in length to try to make the system somehow produce acceptable results. She was at the point, and this was a few years ago, and I'm sure it's worse now, at least in Texas I'm sure it is, to where she was told exactly what thing to teach on which day of each year. And many teachers I know maintain two sets of books because they knew that this standardized curriculum, this teacher-proof stuff didn't work, and so that was what they officially did, and when no one was listening or looking, they went to what they actually did, because something that would work a little bit better. And there have been official reaffirmations of this Nation at Risk declaration. Most recently, in a relatively little-known February 2001 report on national security, another presidential commission declared in about 5 pages worth in this report that our education system was a national security threat. And not much different than what Admiral Hyman Rickover said in 1959 when Sputnik had been up in the air a few years, that our education system was a national security risk then. So as I was flying over here, I decided I would insert something in my speech because I was talking to one of the other passengers, and he reminded me of what's called the horse story. And interestingly, I can see from your reaction, yeah, I've heard this, and I've seen it bounce around, and I know that when I first heard it was arrived as a slip of paper in my wife's mailbox at her school from her principal. And apparently it had been Xeroxed a few million times because it was pretty blurry looking. But basically it said, when you're riding a dead horse, what should you do? And then get off. We don't do that in public education. They went through 50 things that they were doing to try to revive the dead horse. That's why we're where we are at, depending on how you count, 20 years after Nation at Risk or 48 years after Hyman, 44 years after Hyman Rickover's book declaring pretty much the same thing. We're beating a dead horse, and by that I mean the process by which we make decisions about education. I don't mean to say that all the schools are bad. I know that almost all of them could be better for the $8,000 per student per year we spend. And by the way, I think that's the way you should pose it when you talk to your friends. Don't tell them how bad their school is, even if it is. Say, look what you can buy in the private sector for $8,000 per child per year. That's what we're spending nationally. I'm sure it's higher in California. But national average is about $8,000. This horse story has found its way into another acronym, MOTS-H, More of the Same Harder. One of the things that we've achieved in the last 20 years is that we've documented, across 50 states at least, that we've tried everything. You know, everything in the way of reviving this dead horse to get this system, this way of deciding how to spend school taxes and decide what goes into textbooks and curriculum. This system is dead, and the things that we've been doing for the last 20 or so years are more of the same, harder, recycled acts of proven failure. And of course, as David's comments pointed out, this couldn't happen anywhere else except in a system where people are forced to pay no matter what the performance is, or to quote another eminent squalor. Scholar, who unfortunately has passed away already, Quentin Quaid, it's a public finance monopoly. I mean, that's what we have. I mean, it's not a monopoly in the sense that there's only one agent that controls all the schools, but it's a public finance monopoly in the sense that the school in your area has about a $6,000 price advantage over anybody that might want to compete. I mean, you're perfectly free to compete with a public school for their students. It's just you've got to charge to pay your bills, and they don't. And you've got to compete in the teacher labor market with your tuition dollars, and they've got $6,000 to $8,000 a student or more in some places to compete in that market and others. So anyway, if you're riding a dead horse, you should get off. Another way to put the same thing, a book by Myron Lieberman that got me interested in the subject, got me to write these two books that I've written. Public Education and Autopsy. Okay, and I've said that a little too fast. Public Education, an autopsy. Wonderful 1993 book, Harvard University Press. Look it up on Amazon, by Myron Lieberman. And, you know, it pretty much documents that, you know, the horse is dead, and it's getting stiffer and smellier, which is what dead things do. And, you know, I can smell it in my classroom, you know, when I try to get a student to go study, and they won't unless I give them the questions in advance and say, well, I won't change it much by the time you ask them, and they're used to being taught a test. Anyway, I don't want to take a while. How long do we have? I don't even bother my first page. Anyway, I don't want to take a while. See, you asked me to be first, and I warned you. So I got rolling on this, but okay. Anyway, read Public Education and Autopsy. Again, it's about the process. Now, there are many good schools now. Again, it could be better. And they're succeeding in spite of the system. And they'll be better if we institute school choice, which is what we need to do. I mean, that's the answer. The horse is dead. We need to get off. We need to walk at first, hopefully find another horse, okay? But one that walks a little differently than the one that currently, the one that's dead that we're trying to revive. Hope triumphs over experience with a little help from inertia. We have a system that's truly mind-boggling in what it assumes versus what we know to be fact. Government control of education, I mean, that's something that used to scare most of us. The idea that the government was going to decide what our kids learn. But now this is the most discouraging thing to me. You go to a cocktail party and talk to somebody that's relatively educated, and they can't imagine anything else other than the government deciding what your children should learn. Again, that used to scare a lot of us, and probably most of you in this room it does, but not most people. It's what they insist on. The system that we have now assumes that political control of curriculum can yield something other than some mishy-mashy something that a political majority can somehow coalesce along because it's the only thing they can agree to, and it's just kind of a dumbed-down version of curriculum. But yet we assume that working together that we will create this wonderful curriculum that we'll all agree with. It's not going to happen. We're too different, which is another reason we need school choice. We're too different. We can't all be educated to learn exactly the same things in exactly the same way, and we should give up trying. Our current system assumes that monopolies can work well. As I said, it's a public finance monopoly. There's no competition. The public school has a $6,000 or so dollar per student per year price advantage over any potential competitor, including most other public schools. The system assumes that incentives don't matter, that people work just as hard and innovate just as hard and do all the same things, whether they get rewarded for success or punished for failure or not. The system assumes that children, because they're put in schools based on attendance areas, that they can and should be taught the same things in the same way. Utterly ridiculous, a denial of all the diversity that all of us see around us all the time. Even some of you, if you don't have a large family, you know somebody that has a large family, you know that even within a family the children are different enough that you shouldn't educate all of them in the same way, the same thing in the same way. What about in a neighborhood? You just shouldn't have attendance areas. You need to have specialization, and you can't assign people to specialized schools, so you have to have school choice. And then when you have that, then you have competition, which is something else that we desperately need. And last but not least, our system assumes that specialization doesn't matter in terms of productivity or attention span in terms of the students, but it does. We know that it does. We know that specialization is the cornerstone of productivity, but we've created a system that makes that impossible. Again, you can't assign children to a specialized school. You just can't do it because the mismatches would be huge. Now what we have is children assigned to schools that are sort of kind of reasonably okay if they're managed well for everyone, but not really very good for anyone. What we need is a system in which there are diverse schools, specialized schools, in which at least one of them is an outstanding choice for every child, rather than to try to create a system or have the current system that we have, wherein supposedly every school can educate every child. Not going to happen. They're too different. And last but not least in this list of things that we assume about our system that aren't true, that politics works better than markets in terms of motivating and creating, right? Because the proponents of the current system insist on political control, democratic control. You hear that all the time. and they vilify profiteering and markets. So we know that profit and loss and competition is the best way to bring out the best in people. We can see that all over the world. And it's not profiteering. It's people taking a chance on there might be something left over after all the other bills are paid. You know, and if they're lucky and they do really well, there's a lot left over, but there might not be anything left over at all. Even, and this is part of the message that I that wrote that got me involved in this in the first place, but I still regret. I have to trash some of my fellow choice advocates because, you know, sadly, it's true. And I try not to trash them by name. I just trash their ideas because it's not personal. But even many choice advocates are pretending that the horse is not dead. You know, they propose systems, and systems like Milwaukee and Cleveland and Florida, which are okay. I'm not against having them. But they propose these as the answer to the problem that we have, which is a nation at risk, a dysfunctional school system, a school system that needs to be transformed. Okay? But those programs are too small and there are too many restrictions on them to achieve that result. Okay? Those programs are okay for what they're doing, but they shouldn't be hyped as what we ought to be doing to change the system. They only involve 5 to 10% of the children in those school systems. And the private schools are still at a huge disadvantage in competing with the public schools. They're not the answer to where we need to go. But, again, some of my fellow choice advocates are pretending the horse isn't dead, and they're appeasing an unrelenting enemy with proposals that assure the system will prevail. And if we've learned anything out of the various battles, most of which we've lost on school choice so far, that it doesn't matter how much choice or how little choice we propose. The resistance and what they're willing to say, most of which isn't true, and spend money to put it on the TV, doesn't vary with whether you're just advocating something as relatively limited as charter schools or something like a Cleveland-style voucher program, which offers a little less than $3,000 to somebody to leave a school system that spends over $10,000 per child. The resistance is the same. I mean, they took that all the way to the Supreme Court to try to strike that down. So, in conclusion, but this conclusion takes a long time. So, in conclusion, and see, the conclusion is over half of what I have to say. But in conclusion, to end the practice of recycling proven failure and achieve genuine reform, we have to put the children before the system and achieve the minimum requirements of a competitive market as a starting point. As a starting point. So, in other words, that's the minimum starting point. From there, we can take things incrementally, but we're not going to achieve the minimum requirements of a market system, choice, specialization, free entry, exit. I'm starting to sound like an economics professor. I apologize. We're not going to achieve that incrementally. Right? To get the ball rolling, we have to have competitive forces as a starting point, and then from there on, you know, there's a lot of turns on the road we can take, get the government completely out of the system. I know a lot of people favor that, and I'm depending on what day it is and what side of the bed I get up on. It depends on whether I'm one of them or not, that we should go for that. But a competitive market, these minimum key elements of a competitive, are on the road to anything that's worth doing in the way of school reform. So what do we mean by these minimum requirements? A level playing field for all school operators. If I have a couple seconds to tell somebody what I have in mind for reforming schools, what I tell them is end the discrimination against private school users. Treat them the same. They paid into the system just like anybody else did. Their children are entitled to a share of the money just like anybody else did. Ending discrimination against private school users, private schools being those defined by our compulsory education laws as being a school. Ending that discrimination would achieve what Milton Friedman said would happen, namely, competition, and once we institute it somewhere, it would spread like wildfire over the rest of the country. So anyway, that's what a level playing field for all school operators means. The government can't favor its own schools. Now, the degree to which they can, you could debate that, but I would prefer to stand on principle and not give that up. And then once you'd give that up, that okay, we can favor them a little bit. So that's what Prop 38 did. It said, okay, the children in the system get twice as much money as those who leave it. Prop 38 wasn't too bad, but that was a serious flaw because that says that the system is more important than the children. No, it's not. The children are that's why we tax ourselves, is to help the children, not to keep alive a process. We have to keep reminding ourselves that our school system, and I'm talking about the whole thing, not just the public part, the whole thing is just a process, a way of deciding how money gets spent, how decisions get made. And there's nothing sacred about that. Our children come before keeping it. So the government can't favor its own schools, and that means ending discrimination against private school users. Another critical element that we have to have as a starting point, and one of my biggest disappointments when I look at voucher programs, one of the easiest things that my fellow school choice advocates feel that they can jettison is market-determined tuition. And Cleveland allows you, for some cases, makes you pay 10% on top of the voucher to get your kid into the school. But since it's capped at 10%, it doesn't really allow the market to set tuition there. Milwaukee, the purveyors of private schools have to accept the voucher's full payment. There's a price control. Price controls are a disaster. Price controls are a poison pill. We already see a little teeny bit of evidence in Florida of how much difference this makes. They have two kinds of vouchers in Florida. There's the regular vouchers, which price controlled, again, the school operators, the private schools have to accept the voucher worth half what they spend on the public schools as full payment. But the vouchers for the special ed kids, that's the other program they have in Florida, that's not, you can supplement that with private funds. Permission to do that creates the market, sets the market in motion in setting prices. And lo and behold, when they ease that restriction, I have an email to this effect just recently. I think they tripled the number of schools almost overnight that were willing to participate. If only they could charge what they wanted to and didn't have to set it right at the level of the voucher, sometimes just a little more than the voucher, then they were willing to play ball. That attracted some entrepreneurs. So that's just a little, you know, it's still a tiny voucher program, and it's not anywhere near universal, but it gives us a little hint of how important market-determined pricing tuition is. And last but not least on our list, abbreviated list for the purposes of this evening, is the freedom to diversify. Okay? Schools have to be free to configure their programs and charge whatever they want. And we need that because, well, specialization is a cornerstone of productivity. Different kids like things differently than others. Different kids learn in different ways than others. And so we need a system with diverse schools, and that means light regulation, school choice, and, again, market-determined tuition so that the school operators can offer something that costs a little bit more than the voucher or tuition tax credit amount. A phase-in is perfectly fine for doing this. That's perfectly fine. Now, incrementalism, passing legislation in steps to achieve these, no, that's not good because that's not going to happen. Government programs are very difficult to change. You get cast in stone on your first and second step. But passing it in the first legislation and saying, okay, it's going to take 10 years to take effect or 5 years, that's all right. So as long as the entrepreneurs know where the end point is and what the school system's going to look like, that'll give them some time to get going. That's fine. But to create a Milwaukee-like program 1 year and to think, okay, incrementally that's going to morph itself into another program and then we're going to pass some more legislation and then, you know, they're going to pass another piece of legislation to ease those restrictions, that's not going to happen. We can already see that in Milwaukee. It's 10 years later, and they eased one restriction, namely the number of kids that could participate from 1% to 15%. But that's it. The other main restrictions they still have, and I don't see anybody talking about getting rid of those, other than me. And I'm not a taxpayer in Wisconsin or a voter. Well, they're pretty much just stuck. In fact, in Milwaukee, they aren't even using all the vouchers. Apparently the private sector is up to as far as they want to go at whatever the voucher amount is now, $5,000-something, which is about half what the Milwaukee public schools do. So we can accept a phase-in, but we have to achieve all of the key elements in the initial legislation. And it just may not take effect right away. That's all right. So again, problems, defeats, you know, this is too radical, the public isn't ready, all the things that I've heard, whatever, doesn't change that basic fact. You know, we have to achieve as a starting point. It may take us a while to get there. We can't keep spending big bucks on propositions, you know, in California or elsewhere that aren't going to get it done. We may have more work to do before the public is ready, and part of that is to eliminate some debilitating fallacies. Before I get into that, let me just make one other point about the Milton Friedman-like voucher or tax credit thing that we need to implement these key elements. I try not to be a political pundit too often, but I firmly believe that a universal choice program where there isn't favoritism for the government school over the private ones would have fared better. I don't know whether it would have passed or not. But one of the reasons that it would have fared better would have solved the school equity problem. Right? If you, you know, if you allocate as a starting point the same amount of dollars to each child, that takes care of that. Okay? Whereas other the other kind of voucher program, that hasn't been addressed. Second of all, a Milton Friedman-style program would be cheaper. You're not funding two separate systems. It's just one system. This choice system funds all the schools. Excuse me. And last but not least in this little list of why limited choice doesn't fare as well politically as broader universal choice, it's a drag to have to apologize for the impact on the system. This, you know, that's what school choice advocates are often doing, saying, well, our vouchers, that won't hurt public schools. Well, let it hurt public schools. I'm sorry. It's just a process. Okay, that there's so much capacity in the public schools that there's no way for any program, even if you didn't phase it in, to do anything other than, even in the worst case scenario from the other side where they keep talking about public school abandonment, even if they're right, they can't be abandoned very fast. That's where all the teachers are, or the vast majority, and that's where almost all the classroom space is. Even if people want to stampede for the gates, like at a nightclub, you know, like in Chicago, there's no place to go for very many of them, right? And so gradually, you know, they may be right. It may gradually cause abandonment of the public school system, but it's not going to happen very fast. It'll be a gradual transition. And again, frankly, I don't care. I really don't care whether people love their public schools or not. Okay? If they think that they're fine and they stay there, and if they have the option to leave and they don't, that's fine. Again, child first system, you know, the system is the one that the people pick when they have a choice on a level playing field. Okay, now what about these fallacies that we have to attack, the work that we have to do in order to...
Yeah.
2 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, all right. Okay, 2 minutes, all right. One of the fallacies that people suffer from is that, well, I'm in a really good school, which means better than the other ones that are really bad. But better doesn't mean good. Again, opposed to them, what do you think you could get for $8,000 per child from the private sector? Because that's what you're paying, you know, through your taxes through the public sector. Only low-income kids need help. Now the whole system's broken. They're only getting shafted worse than the others. I'm sorry, I'm speeding up, so abbreviating there a little bit, some of the nicer language I might have used. And a really annoying fallacy, and probably not as bad really as the other one, but particularly annoying when I hear people talk about this, is that the existing menu contains all the possible choices. People act like a voucher program would only slightly enlarge the private sector, and it would still be 80% run by churches and 98% nonprofit. And it would look exactly like the same it does now, only a little bigger. No. In fact, there's every reason to believe that the churches probably wouldn't increase the number of students very much. Many people are in church-run schools now. That's the only game in town other than their public school. And if there was school choice, they would leave for a secular private school. The churches would gain some children that currently aren't in church-run schools that want to be there but they can't. So they would probably break even. The big growth would be in the ones that are profit-based and that aren't run by nonprofit churches or other nonprofits for that matter. So we need to attack the enemy also where it's weakest, okay? Which means probably not try again in California or Michigan, at least not for a while, because that's about where the teacher unions are strongest, not weakest. So we need to do some work. Pete shook his head. Peter shook. So maybe they're not. Maybe they're stronger even yet somewhere else. They'll tell us. Yeah.
So much to defeat this thing.
Yeah, true. But well, cost us something too, and the longer cost for us is the defeatism that results in these little programs that result from that. Anyway, so you didn't think we were going to have a debate today, did you? I thought preaching to we still may do that. Okay, anyway, these modest escape hatch programs are not the things that we as choice advocates should be pursuing. They'll happen naturally from politicians compromising and, you know, we can't agree on doing what we need to do. And what we should always pursue is something that will transform the system, that will create, and then if we have to settle for something less, fine. But don't propose something less. Don't propose losing the battle or losing the war just to win a little battle along the way and have some headlines and say, yay, we won something, because we may not have won anything worth winning long term. Okay, well, anyway, that was 3/4 of what I had to say, and I'm sure my 2 minutes are up, so I'm sure the rest will come up in questions. Thank you. See you.
Thank you very much, John.